Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Register. Sherry Register's Are Those Kids Yours? Was one of the first books written for parents about international adoption. In her book Beyond Good Intentions, she looks back on her experience raising two daughters from Korea and what she has learned from others as well. She has also written the award-winning Packing House Daughter, a memoir of a working-class childhood and a famous meatpacker's strike. A Ph.D. in Scandinavian literature, she currently teaches writing at Minneapolis's center, The Loft. Hi, Sherry. How are you?
Hi. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you in Pittsburgh. You're going to be reading from your book, Beyond Good Intentions. Is that
That's right.
Okay.
And what inspired me to write this book was that adult adoptees, particularly from Korea, had begun writing their memoirs or speaking out about their experience. And it put a lot of parents on the defensive. And I got concerned about that, so the piece I'll read addresses that issue. We well-meaning parents are hardly thrilled to learn that our children are unhappy or disappointed or faring poorly in life. What did I do wrong? We ask ourselves as we grope for the quickest fix to the problem. If they persist in being unhappy despite the solutions we offer, we get frustrated and feel inadequate. If they insist on telling us things we'd rather not hear, we feel blamed, maybe even blameworthy. Avoiding blame is a human instinct so powerful it may close our ears to what our children are actually telling us. It's not my fault, we proclaim, maybe implying that our children have made themselves unhappy. Underneath this defensiveness lies a grandiose fallacy about parenthood, the belief that how our children fare in life is a direct measure of our competence. Adoptive parents are especially prone to the myth of the all-powerful parent. When you take on responsibility for a child who wasn't born to you and to whom you had no previous obligation, you become a very deliberate parent, one who has presumably put much forethought into child raising. When you adopt internationally, you agree to an extra set of challenges, such as loving a child of another race whom others in your community, even your family, might think unlovable. It's natural to take pride in being open-minded and generous and willing to charge in where others fear to tread. While some parents decline the moral kudos, others feel entitled to virtue's reward, a happy, loyal, and grateful child. To be cleared for adoption, you must survive the scrutiny of social workers. You describe how you would handle situation A and prevent situation B until you convince everyone that you can pull off this daunting job. It's easy to see how you might come through this process, believing that everything that happens after placement depends solely on you. Whether you've been advised to downplay your child's origins or to emphasize them, you expect that certain actions will have certain predictable consequences. You are in control now. If you stick to the plan, your children will be happy and ever grateful. If they turn out ornery or distant or depressed, well, you rack your memory for what you might have done wrong. If you recall some instance where you slipped up, you feel guilty, an unpleasant feeling to bear. If you don't find any wrongdoing, maybe you conclude that your child is the deficient one. In either case, you feel obliged to defend yourself. You meant well. You followed all the expert advice. You did your best. You were a loving parent. How can it be your fault? You're so caught up in absolving yourself that you can't even hear correctly. Your child isn't blaming you for anything. She's only trying to tell you how she feels. It's not about you at all.
Okay. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Register. She's reading from her book, Beyond Good Intentions, which deals with the experience of raising two daughters from Korea. So it's interesting listening to you read and I've heard you talk about this also briefly, and I have to say straight up that I'm an adoptee, even though I'm an interviewer here, and it's hard to separate those at times. When you introduced that segment, it sounded like you were going one way, and then you went another way, you know? And, you know, speaking as the defensive adoptive parent almost, and then at the end saying, it's not about you, you know, and you can't even hear at times. Can you talk a little bit about how, as an adoptive mother, you have avoided being defensive?
I've had to learn that. Mm-hmm. I've had 30 years to learn it because my oldest daughter is now 30. And have had to train myself really hard just to listen and not to respond either with defensiveness or with a quick fix to the problems as I diagnose the problems, but just to hear them out. And I've also had to absolve myself of my perfectionism as a parent. I think that's been both a struggle and also very liberating to realize that in the long run, as long as I don't do anything egregious to my children, you know, how they turn out often just depends on their character, their personality, the choices they make in life, as long as they have just some kind of sound foundation. And it's not up to me to see that process through to the end, you know, moment by moment and decision by decision.
Right. Right. I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Betty Jean Lifton.
Right.
And where she talks about the, there's a sentence in her book, Journey of the Adopted Self, where she says the, I don't have it completely exact, but something about the fee that the adopted child is supposed to pay is one of gratitude.
Right.
And that word gratitude came up a couple times in what you just read. And that seems to me a huge problem.
Yeah.
And it seems to me you'd be really effective talking to other adoptive parents who aren't getting it.
Yeah, I think a couple of things we need to do is divorce adoption from the notion of rescue.
Mm-hmm.
We are not saving our children from anything. We are depriving them in a lot of ways, especially internationally, of the culture that they left as well as their birth families. And that we are, in turn, bound to a debt of gratitude because they have enabled us to have the family life that we sought.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a movie called Adopted that has come out recently, a documentary. And the woman who's interviewed in there says that parents adopt, but the adoptees adapt. And in most cases, we do expect our children to adapt to our habits and our values rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you read another segment?
Sure. This one is about being normal and abnormal. There's always a debate going on about whether adoption and adoptive families are normal or pathological. Some talk about adoption syndrome, that we can kind of expect behavior problems with our children. And so I've tried to give that some kind of different context too. The trick we parents need to master is to see our children's uprooting as traumatic without pathologizing the child as damaged, a hapless victim perennially incapable of caring for herself. That troubling behavior is a fairly normal adolescent response to an abnormal circumstance. Yes, adoption is a fine way to form a family. Yes, family life is generally better than orphanage care. Yes, adoption saves children from homelessness, disability, and even death. But it is not ideal or trouble-free. Being separated from family and displaced at a tender age to a foreign culture where sights, sounds, smells, tastes are vastly different is an abnormal circumstance. So is growing up in a family of another race than your own, in a setting where your race defines you as exotic or inferior. Adapting to abnormal circumstances takes effort at any age. The emotional part of that effort is beyond a child's understanding. Even the facts of adoption are confusing. Feelings emerge with stunning power before the capacity to make rational sense of them develops. Long simmering grief can erupt as anger. Fueled by surging hormones, anger lets loose as rage or gets subdued into depression. Grief has few proper, safe outlets. Even people who simply cry it out are likely to be cast as troubled if they don't quickly dry their tears and get back to business. Grief can as easily take expression or seek comfort in shoplifting, promiscuous sex, eating disorders, self-mutilation, violence, or drug abuse, behaviors readily available anyway to youth in Western countries. Nearly all adoptive families encounter times of crisis that could be eased by therapy. The purpose of skilled and knowledgeable therapy is not to fix the child, but to help the whole family reveal unspoken feelings and understand where they come from and learn non-destructive ways to release them. The bold testimony of adult adoptees who describe the rough times they have been through scares some parents into a neurosis of control. "Not my child," they insist, and they rev up their psychic vacuum cleaners, determined to clean out the festering residue of adoption trauma and send it off to the lab to be diagnosed. Their refuge is a medical model that matches prescribed treatment to precisely identified problems. They miss the other vitally important message in the adult adoptee's testimony. "We are not weak and pitiful. We are healthy, normal human beings who have suffered and survived massive loss and dizzying confusion."
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Register. She's reading from her book, Beyond Good Intentions, which looks back on her experience raising two daughters from Korea. There's a lot I've noticed in what you've read. Some of the language is disturbing, as in proper and normal. And yet then, again, you go on to take it apart a little bit. But I also noticed that you talk about, you talked about saving children from life on the streets, but then before you said that adoptive parents weren't saving. So
right. And I think I've become stronger on that issue since all the talk around the earthquake in Haiti about rescuing children. And when I use it in here, it's sort of just to acknowledge that there are cases in which the child would have been in jeopardy if not adopted, but that's not the primary motive for adopting. So
right. I always balk when I hear that word normal, you know.
And what I've been working toward is to define a new norm for adoptive families. And you know, when you meet together with other adoptive families, which I do frequently, you discover commonalities of experience that become a new normality. It may be different from what birth families experience, like separation anxiety. You know, our children almost all have episodes of that. And you think, well, anybody who's gone through abandonment is likely to fear being abandoned again. And so that seems like a very normal response. We need to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed over time that some adoptive parents seem to want to erase the history of the adoptee, and that could be partially because, you know, I'm working with an older model of adoption. I know that adoption now is much more open, but it's that seems to be an issue in adoption of, you know, okay, now you're my child, and what happened before doesn't exist. You know, that's not going to be stated, but it might be acted.
Yeah. And I think even with internationally adoptive families who have to be open because everybody can see what happened here, there is a preference for nurturing the sense of cultural heritage over family heritage, that there are parents who can appreciate the child's culture but would rather not acknowledge the birth family. Mm-hmm. And that when children begin expressing any sense of loss, it most often centers on family, not mm-hmm. on heritage.
Right. I know that you have adopted two Korean children who are grown now.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about some of your personal experiences, things that you've learned along the way, surprises that you've had, any story you might want to relate?
My surprises are maybe how much the consciousness of birth family varies at certain stages of development, how intense it can be at times, and then something will click and the child will just turn away from it for a while and be more interested in the moment and in peer relationships, and then it may come back. That's that's been surprising. I think my biggest surprises have probably been around race and learning how much I didn't understand about that, even though I thought I was a pretty knowledgeable white American as far as race goes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand the constancy of it and the intensity of it.
Mm-hmm. You have a piece about that, a short excerpt about exoticizing race.
Yep, I'll find that. When my husband and I decided to adopt in 1980, we knew how complicated it would be to claim an African-American or Native American child as our own. Yet we attributed the controversy about transracial adoption to the particular history of slavery and genocide in the United States and didn't apply it to international adoption. Though we never sought to adopt internationally for its own sake, adoption from Korea looked like a safe, efficient, and ethically sound possibility, and so we embraced it. I still had some questions and anticipated some difficulty, but I also welcomed the chance to inscribe my family in the emerging global community. In conversations with like-minded parents, we shared our excitement at the adventure we had embarked on. Our multicultural families just might transform the world. We looked forward to being transformed ourselves by the color our children would bring to our humdrum domestic lives. I was reminded of this expectation when I heard the new father of a Russian son extol the cultural benefits of international adoption. His son, he said, brought a rich cultural heritage along with him to the United States, a country that has no culture. Culture, presumably, means embroidered shirts and knee-high boots, not T-shirts and jeans. Lively balalaika music, not jazz or country and western. Onion-domed architecture, not big-box stores with massive parking lots. Borscht, not Campbell's soup. Like white people who presume to have no race, white Americans seldom think of their ways as ethnic, and so we latch on to exotic tastes and habits and artifacts to dress up our lives, which we believe to be basic and ordinary. The issue of cultural appropriation, if not cultural genocide, lurks in international adoption, but living at a distance from the people who might object, prospective parents don't hear enough naysaying to be discouraged. Instead, the vision of global harmony and a lush multiculturalism still governs the choices of some adoptive parents who believe that their love for their children will help to right the balance between their own wealthy countries and the disadvantaged birth countries.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Sherry Register. She's reading from her book entitled Beyond Good Intentions, about adoption. So What then were your surprises about race? You said you thought you knew a lot about it, you know, as a well-informed American citizen, and yet you didn't. What happened to change that?
The first thing I realized was how race conscious my kids were from a very early age. How they would walk into any group of people and they would take the census, and they would know even without counting. They'd even know by instinct who was in that room and how alone they were as Asian faces in the room. And I had thought that, well, Asian people don't suffer the same degree of racism as African-American people, for example. They kind of integrate much better with the white population and so on. But I didn't know about exclusion as an aspect of racism. My daughter, I have a daughter who's currently living in Korea and one who lives in Minnesota. And the one in Minnesota reports to me now often what happens to her at work, that customers will come through. And every day she gets the question, sometimes multiple times, where are you from or what are you? And that question is painful and it's insulting because it translates into you don't belong here. You're different from me. I'm a normal American. You're something else. And it's this perpetual foreigner status that Asians have to occupy. And it has become really painful to me. I get really angry and just kind of burn up inside whenever it happens.
Yeah, people are actually saying, what are you?
What are you? Yeah. And she will, when they say, where are you from? She'll say Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And they say, no, I mean, really, what are you?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. A lot of stupidity out there, but but do you feel that clearly there's a way that you can become angry as an adoptive mother, but there's no way to feel it on the same level as your daughters?
Right. I will never have the pervasive consciousness because I do enjoy white privilege. I can turn on the TV and there will likely be a white face on the TV screen. And I noticed last night in my hotel room, I turned on, there was an Asian anchor on one of the news shows, and it was just stunning to see her because it's so unusual.
Mm-hmm. I think you have one more excerpt that you can read. Could you do that?
Sure. I will read about white people. We white folks claim a right of definition that reserves normality to us. All human groups do the same, but where one group's view dominates, the result is racism, even within transracially adoptive families. Our children are different from us, we think. We seldom regard ourselves as different from them. They are non-white, but we do not call ourselves non-whatever they are. They are minorities, even though on an international scale, people who look like them outnumber people who look like us. They are people of color, which means that we are people of no color. In calling ourselves white, despite our pink or beige or olive hues, we imagine ourselves unmarked by race, humanity distilled to its purest, most natural form. Everyone else is named and defined according to how they deviate from the basic human type we presume to be. We are indeed colorblind, but it's our own color we're blind to. In fact, we are racially marked in the extreme. How and where we live, how we see the world, what we believe, what we take for granted, what we fear, the way we walk and speak, the values we hold dear all depend on our whiteness.
If you were talking to someone who is about to do a transracial adoption, what kind of advice might you give to them?
Well, two quick things that I say are don't adopt from a country you wouldn't be willing to live in for a while, and don't adopt a child of a race or ethnicity if you would not be willing to marry a person of that origin. The other thing I would say is absolutely do not raise your child in racial isolation, even if it means uprooting yourself somehow. And also, this I got from my daughter, it's her big message, is give your child opportunities to learn about their ethnic heritage, but don't force them to take on an identity that they don't choose for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Did you find when you first got your children that you were stereotyping them without knowing it?
Oh, sure, I was. Yeah. And I believe that they would always be kind of gloriously Korean. And instead, what they've become is they're Asian American, because that's an umbrella category that's very welcoming to them. And they are adult international adoptees, which has become its own ethnic group.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard for you to deal with your own racism when you discovered it?
You know? It was humbling. Mm-hmm. And I just knew, well, I've got to get on board with this, and mm-hmm. I've got to try to figure this out. And if I do make any errors along the way, they will correct me.
Yeah, that's sort of a good thing. Well, I know that you teach classes at the Loft in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. These are writing classes, or are they classes related to adoption?
I teach creative nonfiction writing, so mainly memoir and personal essay. Mm-hmm. So they are writing craft classes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think we're almost out of time here. Anything that you'd like to leave us with? I know I've already asked you for advice here, but anything that you might want to say to adoptees?
I think what is really important now that is emerging is that adoptees are telling their own stories, and in doing so, they're reframing the whole story of adoption and undoing the mythology of adoption as a romantic happy ending story, making it much more complicated with some happy endings, but not an assumption of do-gooding on the parents' part. And what they're telling is a much richer, more genuine story than the one we've had all along.
Mm-hmm. Is that a welcome addition generally, do you think?
It's hard for a lot of parents. I mean, getting back to the first excerpt that I read, it's parents don't like to surrender that territory. They still want it to be about themselves and their own choices and their own family formation.
Right. Well, thank you so much. It's been great to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's the writing of Sherry Register, and she's been reading from her book, Beyond Good Intentions. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.